You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On the other side of the street, I knew stood a girl that looked like you. I guess that deja vu. I thought this can't be true, cause you moved to West LA or New York or Santa Fe or wherever to get away from.
If you've listened to All Marine Radio at all, you've often heard us discuss. And me with a number of guests, thoughts about a fictitious OPT that would have occurred in Afghanistan that talked about expanding the ground war, and me sitting in the back and putting my hand up and telling everybody how smart I think the whole idea is, but asking, are we prepared to be here if Germany and Japan were 50 to 60 year events? Approximately two generations of citizens, were we prepared to be there for 160 or 260 years? And that question, I didn't think ever got asked, because if you look at history, you look at the history of Afghanistan, you would see that is a pretty daunting challenge, and nobody was going to do a drive-by that would take months, even a few years, on Afghanistan and create anything that would have any lasting impact. So I was reading, and I came across a study from CSIS, which is the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it was done by a Marine whose name I had seen before, and he joins us today to talk about those very issues. In a piece that appears under the heading of Military Advice and the Forever War in Afghanistan. They did a video piece which appears in this link, and you can download the whole report from the CSIS link that is in this report as well. So Mark Kansian joins us. Mark, am I saying your last name right, first of all?
Yes, you did.
All right.
Despite what the Armenian society thinks, Kansian is actually Italian.
We're not going to get in the middle of that fight, trust me. The Armenians, they don't go away. First of all, let's talk about you so people know you. I recognized your name from either things you've written in the Gazette or things you've written, period. Let's talk about you and your career. Born and raised where?
Born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts, and joined the Marine Corps through a PLC program.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? You're probably you're a little bit older than me, so just about everybody who wandered the planet, who coached us, and a lot of people who taught us were all veterans of World War II or Korea at the time. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
You know, I had always thought about the military service, and I'm embarrassed to say that when I was on campus a freshman in college, I went to the Army ROTC. Asked them about what, I know, I'm embarrassed to say that now, but I asked them about what programs they had, but ROTC was being kicked off campus. This was during the era of the Vietnam War. And they said, well, go talk to the Marines, maybe they have something. So I walk over to the Marines, and they say, have we got a deal for you? We've got this PLC program in the Stillmers. So I said, well, that sounds good, you know, spend a relaxing summer in Quantico, Virginia.
Of course.
And, so I spent two summers in the PLC program down in Quantico, and then when I graduated, was commissioned. And you know, went to the basic school like everyone else, and then went off to the artillery school and off to Okinawa for my first tour. And this was right at the end of the Vietnam War, so we did the evacuation of Saigon. Came back to Okinawa, did another tour on actually down at Albany, Georgia, of all places, for an artillery officer.
Yeah.
And the Marine Corps sent me to right. Mm-hmm. I was a company commander down there, essentially a H&S company.
Well, tell me about so what did you do, what was your involvement in the evacuation of Saigon?
Well, you know, this is 1975, and South Vietnam was collapsing, and the Marine Corps sent, a MEB, or MAB, I think, in those days,
MAB, yeah,
down to down to Vietnam to conduct the evacuation. So we ended up, you know, searching a lot of baggage and processing refugees and you know, sort of getting the Vietnamese out. And, of course, a lot of stories from those days that I tell friends in the CIA that the first CIA helicopter I pushed into the South China Sea, because the helicopters would land, you know, there was no room for them on the deck, so we would, you know, empty them, and then we would push them out into the ocean. And then, actually, as another little aside, if we have a moment, I went back to Okinawa, and one night a bunch of us were sitting around, and someone said, hey, the Army nurses are going swimming, you know, like midnight. So, sure. So we went swimming, and I met one of the Army nurses. The MPs come, take our names, throw us out. And now the Army nurse and I have been married for 40 years. And we tell our children that mom and dad were arrested by the military police on their first date.
Did she say that I didn't get arrested, just for the record? That was not me who was arrested. I hope. Wow, what a story. That must have been Chris. So you were on the premises of the embassy in Saigon?
No, we were offshore. I mean, there were some Marines who went through the embassy, but no, we were offshore processing refugees as they came aboard, because they couldn't bring weapons and they could bring money and and things like that, but they couldn't bring weapons. They couldn't bring alcohol either, so some of them would come out with, you know, Napoleon brandy, which we had to throw into the South China Sea. Which was a real tragedy.
I was going to say that, you know, that doesn't sound very marine-like, especially back in those days.
I know, but when the company gunny is watching, you know, people...
Well, he's the last person I would think that would order Napoleon brandy or over the side. I would think he would have put that over in the gunny's wheelbarrow over there.
Our gunny was probably a Baptist.
He probably was. One of the two Baptist gunnies who actually attended services and lived by those rules. Wow. Interesting. And then shoving the helicopters right off in some of the famous videos that we've seen, right off the side of the ship.
Yeah, and it's all true. And then after that, did a quick tour as a company commander down in Albany, and then the Marine Corps sent me off to graduate school, which was a great deal. So I went to graduate school for 2 years, and then...
And so, graduate school in Monterey or someplace else?
I went Harvard Business School.
Oh, you're a Harvard man. So did you do Harvard undergrad?
I did, right. So I have two Harvard degrees.
Wow. One of the few Harvard guys who makes a Marine Corps career.
There were a couple, not very many. And as another aside, before we get to Afghanistan, it's interesting when it happens actually in the Ivy League, because a good friend of mine was a guy named Mossos, who was a very well-known sociologist. He went to Princeton and graduated in like the late 50s, and he said that about one-third of his class at Princeton in the late 50s went into the military. Well, you fast forward 15 years, and in my class at Harvard, there were, out of 1,600, I think there were about a dozen military veterans. So, you know, in that 15 years, you have this tremendous shift in attitudes at the elite schools.
You know, I don't know if you know or know of, I'm sure you know of Carl Marlanis, but he made a similar point. I think Marlanis went to Yale, and he said, you know, there's a whole hallway devoted to, at Yale, to Yalees who were killed in World War I, World War II, blah, 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 blah. And he said, I think it even goes back to the Civil War. He said, there's been nobody since Vietnam, whose picture I think appears on that wall. He said, and he made a similar point about who's doing the fighting these days, and not sure that that's a good idea when such a small portion of the nation does the fighting. But interesting that with the movement of the all volunteer force, that that segment of the population's participation dries up.
Yeah, and this actually predates the all volunteer force.
Right.
It's the Vietnam War, and that essentially made it socially acceptable to dodge the draft, and so you have this change over the 15 years. And Harvard has a similar wall in their memorial church where they've got the World War One, World War Two, Korea, and then Vietnam also. There are, I don't know, a dozen names or so. What is true is that the great fear among the college students that they would be drafted and sent to Vietnam and killed never happens to any Harvard graduate. In other words, all of the graduates who were killed in action were volunteers.
Wow. Interesting. So you go back there, and when you did your graduate work, what subject did you, what discipline were you involved in?
Well, I had to sell it to the Marine Corps, so
right.
I focused on quantitative analysis, and then when I finished at the business school, went to headquarters Marine Corps and did a payback tour. I did 1 year actually at headquarters and then managed to maneuver myself down to the Pentagon and work in the office that was originally systems analysis, founded by McNamara, and it's been through a couple of name changes since then. But I decided that I really liked that work. They basically connected strategy and budgets. And looked at, when you make these big blue arrows, when the strategists make you, what does that really mean in terms of forces and programs? And I found that very exciting. So I did a couple of years down there. Then I left active duty but stayed in the reserves, went back to Boston, and worked on research programs and graduate programs at the Kennedy School at Harvard, my third tour up there. And then came back, which was very interesting and rewarding, and was actually with 1st Battalion, 25th Marines Reserve
up in Boston. Up in Boston.
And
actually, I just spoke to them out in the desert here. 25th Marines, yeah. I do a thing called post-traumatic winning, which is really the lessons I've learned from doing this for about going into my fourth year about how our culture deals with trauma and how it's dealt with it historically. And so I went out there and did that for your old regiment. So interesting.
Yep. And then left the university, came back to Washington, worked in the Pentagon, but then was called up for Desert Storm and did some lessons learned for Desert Storm. Originally, we were going to train follow-on units, and then we ended up doing lessons learned because, of course, the war didn't last very long. And then I got called up again in 2003 to do essentially the same thing. So went overseas again in 2003, and then I retired, and I thought that was the end of it. But then in 2006, when I was in the Pentagon as a civilian, I was talking to our director, who was talking to a senior staff, and he's saying, would you like to do a rotational tour of some sort? You've been in your job for a while. And I said, I'd like to go back to Iraq. I think that the Marines could use some help, and this is going to be, one of the key experiences of this generation. So, I'd like to do a second tour over there. And he said, well, that wasn't really what I was expecting, but I'm happy to help. And so he actually called the assistant commandant, who I knew, and this was April, and in August I was Fallujah and did a second tour in Iraq, and I was the assistant chief of staff for assessments. This is the G7 from August to the following, March. And then when I came back, I retired again. At that point, my wife said, that's enough.
So what year was that?
So this was 2006 to 2007. This was right during the awakening. So it was right at the beginning of the awakening.
Right. So you were at Camp Fallujah?
Yep.
Yeah, I was there with 5th Marines. So we're battle buddies.
Right. I guess we must have bumped into each other in the deck at some point.
At some point, probably. I don't know. I did most of my stuff at night, so maybe I didn't. But so interesting. Interesting. So once you officially retired, then what? So Mark, had I seen your name? Because have you been a long time writer? Have I seen your stuff in the Gazette? Because I saw your name and I said I know that name.
Yes, I started writing when I was a captain, and I wrote about one article a year, maybe sometimes a little more, which doesn't sound like much, but if you do that for 3 years, you end up with quite a corpus of work, and I would write very often in the Gazette. I was on the editorial board, and then was cited as a distinguished author for the Gazette, did a lot of writing for proceedings also, and then, hither and yon. So over the course of the year, I probably have about 40 published articles.
All right.
So that's what you're remembering. And then now at the think tank, that's part of the job. So I do a lot of writing here in town about, various issues.
All right. And when you say here in town, you mean Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, that's right. I forget that you're not here in town.
No, I didn't think you were referring to Costa Mesa, California. So I just wanted to make that clear. No, so I mean most people will recognize your name, and it's spelled CANCIAN, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Okay.
And some people actually may recognize the name because both of our sons served in the Marine Corps. Both our older son and the younger son, they both ended up in the artillery. In fact, when the younger son got his MOS assignment, he said, "Dad, I'm in the family MOS." So both of them did tours in Afghanistan and then got out and went to graduate school. And the older one actually went to medical school. And now he's a Navy doctor.
Wow.
So for people listening in, if you have your hip replaced or your knee replaced someday, it may be Dr. Cancian who does it.
Wow! Well, congratulations. Is the younger one still in the Marine Corps, or what? You said he got out too.
He got out. He went to graduate school. He got his master's at Fletcher up at Tufts, and he's getting his doctorate at MIT.
Got it. Wow.
They've done very well.
Well done. Talk to us about how your career has progressed. Obviously, you've continued to talk along the lines that you embarked upon while still moving in and out of the Marine Corps. So talk about your career post-Marine Corps.
Yeah. When I came back, I retired a second time, and as I say, my wife told me that was it. My job back in the Pentagon had been filled, which was part of the deal. But everyone felt that they owed me something. So they asked me, what would you like to do? Now, I didn't feel that they owed me anything, but it was very convenient having them feel that way. So I said, I think to go work in the White House complex. Maybe Office of Management and Budget. And at that point, I had, some idea of what they did, but not really a great idea. But it turned out the perfect job opened up right as I was looking. So then I moved over to the National Security Division at Office of Management and Budget and ran their branch that looked at force structure and investment. And that was DOD acquisition programs and also the nuclear weapons in the Department of Energy. And that was, so I spent 7 years there, which was fascinating to see a different perspective because there you see the interaction of the agency, the Congress, and the White House. And it's a very different perspective you get than being inside the Pentagon where these outside forces are very often quite nebulous. And then after 7 years, I decided, okay, I had done enough budget reviews that I figured that I've been there, done that. So I started looking around for what might be interesting to do next, and the think tanks had always interested me. So I went on what I called an aggressive lunching program, where I have lunch with everybody I knew who had been in the think tanks, and I belonged to the Army-Navy Club here in town, so I would take everyone to lunch, and people would be delighted to have a free lunch at a nice place. So after doing that for about a year, and I said talking to lots of people, I got a sense about how these think tanks operate, what they're looking for, where they get their money. And then one day, CSIS, someone I knew, called me up and said, "Hey, there's an opening over there. Would you be interested in having me put your name in?" And I said, "Sure." So one thing led to another, and I've been over here for about 4 years.
All right, let's talk about, so what is your official title over there, and what do you officially do?
My title is senior advisor.
Okay.
And that just means I'm old. And I write about military forces, budgets, and operations. But really, you know, in the think tanks, you know, you go out, you look for money, you look for funders who are willing to, you know, support some research, and, you know, you make a deal with them, and then you do the research on whatever, you know, topic they find interesting. So this project, for example, on Afghanistan was something, you know, a topic that they're interested in. I found a funder who was willing to support that, so that's where that came from. A part of the job also in the think tanks is to, you know, keep publishing, so, you know, keep yourself visible. So I talk to a lot of conferences, and, you know, every couple of weeks I'll write an article for, you know, one of the local publications. And then talking to journalists, and, you know, I probably talk to a journalist, and, you know, maybe every other day on some topic, because they've come to know me and they've seen the work that I've been doing. So, and I enjoy that part of the job. That's why I came to a think tank rather than going, for example, to a consulting company. Think tanks, you can have a much more visible presence.
Got it. What's the so? Which do you, first of all, do you like the work? I mean, is it you've had an interesting career, to say the least, where not only the opportunity that have been in front of you, but also some serendipitous events have converged that has made your career pretty unique. What's been the best part of it?
Well, the great thing about the think tanks is that you can write whatever you want. And it doesn't get reviewed. It doesn't go through five levels of editing before it goes out the door. It's and I wasn't really expecting when I came on board. When the first time I wrote an op-ed, I sent it to my boss, the vice president, and she looked at it and she said, "I'm happy to read it, but you don't need my clearance to publish this." I said, "You mean I can just send this to the editor and publish it?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Wow, this is liberating. I have 30 years of op-eds up in my head, and I can just roll them out." So I've been doing that for the last 4 years. So if you like to write, if you want to inflict your opinions on the national security community, the think tanks are a great place to do that, because, you know, there's a lot of and that's part of your job. I mean, it's one of the things actually that we get rated on is, you know, the engagement with journalists and our own writing. The downside is you have to go chase money, and you have to find funders who will support your research, and, you know, that takes a chunk of time. It's very often I will talk to military officers who are getting out of the service, and they're sort of interested in think tanks, and I tell them, this is not a job like you're accustomed to. You know, there isn't a job here that you apply for. You know, if you come on board a think tank, and CSIS is like most think tanks, you get a hunting license. In other words, you can go out and use CSIS's name and go try to find funders. But that's all you get. You know, there's no pot of money that you tap into. So there's a, you know, constant pressure to, you know, find funders. And, I'm doing that. But
Can I ask you a stupid question? So when you go to work for a think tank, it sounds like you run your own business under the broad heading of the think tank. So there's no salary that comes with working at a think tank. For guys who do what you do, you go ahead and you write your own ticket, and you go out and you seek your own funding?
Essentially, yes. I mean, it's extremely entrepreneurial. That is, you know, both on the funding side and on the intellectual side. You create a brand on, you know, programs and ideas that you think are important, and you create that brand out there so people, you know, sort of associate you with, certain perspectives. But yes, people should think about it as an entrepreneurial opportunity, not like a bureaucracy. It's not like the government, you know, where there's a job and money and you apply, and if you're selected, you go and you do the job and you get the, you know, the salary that goes with that job.
Well, that's it. Because my instinct would think, my instinct would tell me that it's more academic than entrepreneurial, and you just turn that upside down. Obviously, it's not.
Yeah. It's not. And it's actually quite different from academia in a couple of respects. I mean, one was in academia, there is a job there, you know, generally a teaching job. And you get teaching, and then very often people will do research or get grants in addition to their basic teaching salary. But there's also a big difference in the kind of research that people do. One of the criticisms of the academy is that over time, its research has become much more specialized, much more inward focused, not focused on policy issues, and also more partisan. So they don't speak to Washington decision makers. You know, the research they do talks to other academics, but not to the Washington decision makers. And that opened up a space for think tanks, and that's one reason why you've seen this great expansion in the number of think tanks. CSIS was one of the first. It was established in, I think, 1962. Since then, of course, there are lots and lots of them. But the space has opened because academic institutions are not meeting the needs of policymakers.
All right, let's talk about, so I'm minding my own business, right, cruising through life. You heard in my preamble when I introduced you that, you know, as somebody who spent close to 3 years of my life in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're executing a strategy, you're part of executing a strategy that is supposed to take the nation to a better place, supposed to take the international community to a better place. And then you go there and you see people killed, and it's troubling because you see the national aim, right, not being fulfilled. You see phase four not happening the way you believed that phase four was supposed to happen in your head. And so I have that stuff in my head. And I'm living my life, and I see this headline. Tell me how it ends. Military advice, strategic goals, and the forever war in Afghanistan. And so I look at that and I say, I don't know who wrote that, but, like, that's something that I want to read. Then I see your name, and obviously other bells go off in my head. Tell me about your path to this project.
I came at this project from two aspects. One was, I think, the one that drove you and many others. That is, we've been in Afghanistan for 18 years. We've spent something like $800 billion. We've had 2,400 casualties. But no one in the military was saying in 2001 that this thing was going to be, that we would still be there 18 years later, and that at best we would have a stalemate. So my question was, okay, how did that happen? Now, how did we go from where we were in 2001, never expecting this, to where we are today? The other thing was that there's a tendency on the military side to blame civilians, to argue that they were stabbed in the back. That is, that the civilians set some goals, did not give the military the resources and support it needed, therefore the military failed and it's all the civilians' fault. And I was just never very comfortable with that narrative. It's not that the civilians don't deserve a lot of blame and criticism, but I didn't feel that the military was blameless either. And because of my background, I'm more comfortable making that argument, I think, than many civilian researchers. So both of those sort of paths led me to produce this study.
All right, so let's talk about it, because in my fictitious OPT, right, everybody knows that after September 11th, and again, to me, this your argument, you talk about military advice, strategic goals, and the forever war in Afghanistan. I mean, you could flip that over to Iraq and have a very, very similar discussion about the intellectual rigor devoted to that issue and what people were thinking. But so talk to me about how does this happen? Because we all, everybody believes that, in fact, there was just this week, the Pew Institute, is that what they're called? Pew Research, put out a poll, and I want to say 85% of military guys who, let me pull it up right here, and I'll give you the exact numbers, unless you know them off the top of your head. Here they are. They sampled 1,284 veterans and 187 other adults, and 64% of veterans said the Iraq War wasn't worth fighting, considering the cost, and 58% of veterans said the same about Afghanistan. That's pretty daunting. Those numbers are pretty daunting. The reason I use those numbers to illustrate, just about everybody believes that going to Afghanistan was something that the nation had to do in the wake of September 11th. Talk to me about the decision to expand the ground war. And how that happened and what didn't happen, because I believe that one of the great crises in the military, in the structure of the American military, is the number of bobbleheads we have that wear stars in all the branches of the service, that they are not prepared to speak truth to power in a blunt public way, that we have too many conformists that are more concerned about being promoted than they are about living up to the oath that they take to the American people and preventing the nation from these kind of military disasters, if you will. And so with that said, how can you lay out the path of how we go from hunting Osama bin Laden, destroying the elements that existed in Afghanistan that attacked the United States, then to a war that has at its aim to refashion Afghan society into something that's never existed in the history of that territory, if you will?
Absolutely. And let me start by reinforcing your earlier point about public opinion, because with Afghanistan, it's important. The question you ask is important. If you ask people the question, did the United States make a mistake invading Afghanistan in 2001, you get relatively low numbers. In other words, most people believe it was the right thing to do in 2001. If you ask them the question, should we be staying in Afghanistan, then the support goes way, way down. And it's that latter question, I think, that you and I are interested in. In other words, should we still be there? Not did we make a mistake in 2001. The bottom line on the study is that the mission shifted in 2002 to 2004 from a narrow focus on counterterrorism and al-Qaeda, as you note, to a very broad agenda of nation building. And at that point, the senior military officers should have thrown a flag down and said, okay, we can probably do this, but it's going to take two generations. Do you really want to make that commitment? And as far as I can tell, there was zero discussion about what this change in mission was going to entail for the duration and intensity of the war. And when I say nation building, and of course that's a very emotionally laden term nowadays, you could call it comprehensive counterinsurgency if you wanted to, use a euphemism. But that's a whole set of goals. And it includes, for example, a state with a strong central government, the impartial rule of law, political leadership chosen through democratic processes, religious differences tolerated, I'm reading from the report, speech uncensored, a market economy operating, human rights respected, and women and girls empowered. And that package I call nation building, and that is what the U.S. shifted to in this 2002-2004 timeframe. And there were a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is understandable. That is, the Taliban had been defeated, and there was this feeling that the sky was the limit. There were no restrictions on what could be accomplished in Afghanistan. The country could be transformed because there was no, you know, force opposing that. There was also a belief that the only way you could truly make, you know, a sustainable Afghanistan that could be counted on to keep al-Qaeda out would be to transform it into a 21st century modern state. So both of those were operating. But no one looked back at the history of these things and said, you know, this is going to take 50 years. You know, your average Afghan soldier isn't even literate. And you're talking about, you know, this transformation. And I emphasize that the problem isn't that these nation-building goals are wrong. I mean, these all represent the way we in the West believe that society should be organized. It's not the goals. The problem was imposing them on a nation that was very underdeveloped, very highly religious, very patriarchal, tribally based, and having been devastated by, you know, 25 years of civil war.
Well, to me, that's half the problem, right? Is that you know, and one of the things I remember discussing with my friends is that, you know, God, we're awful in phase four, right? So we've done the job kinetically, and now we set about fashioning something, you know, that we wanted to achieve, you know, politically, and we use the military because war is politics by other means. And so now we've taken care of the kinetic piece of this, and now we're going to fashion that, which we need fashion, so this thing will be a solid piece in the world, you know, community. That vision. But now, as I thought about this last night, as I thought about this interview, one of the things I thought about was, when your vision from the start is fundamentally skewed, you then try to fashion something and reality, right, butts up against your folly, right, your misconception, you know, you're reaching beyond what you can possibly achieve, and that's where the thing begins to break down, because your vision was never even close to being something that was within the realm of possibilities. And so to me, you could, you know, it's like, I flip it to Iraq, right? The war plan said, and I had General Zinni on, and he said, Mac, the war plan predicted everything that would happen in Iraq. If you didn't go there with over 300,000, you know, soldiers, Marines, people on the ground, that you would have a civil war in short order. That happened. And we tried to play whack-a-mole, and it simply didn't work. And so in looking at Iraq, right, how we ever thought that we could, you know, we could fly some expats in, turn the government over to them, and this thing that had been carved up by the Brits would stay together and become this moderate, you know, Arab nation, is the greatest folly. So when it falls apart in phase four, and we now have an insurgency and a civil war all going on, who's the stupid one? And so Mark, how could we have such a rose-colored assessment of what we're capable of, even given the backdrop of American exceptionalism? There's got to be people, you know, that are schooled, that will stick their hand up and say, are you kidding me? Have you not seen the Soviet example here? And their methods aside, right, did you not see what they ran into? And can you talk to us about, how do we just drive over that stuff like speed bumps?
Yes, and in fact, let me focus on Afghanistan, since that's what I've been studying recently, but I think much of this does apply to Iraq. But yes, in the report, I note that there were a variety of things that the United States ignored. You know, this is the hubris of a superpower, that, you know, history does not constrain us. And the Soviets is one excellent example, because when you read people's accounts, the memoirs, there's almost no discussion about the Soviets. And what there is that, well, the Soviets lost, therefore they are, you know, we can ignore them because they lost. And the second thing is, we're liberators, they were invaders, so, you know, we are in a fundamentally different position. Now, there's some truth to that, you know, in the sense that when the United States liberated Afghanistan from the Taliban, there was a lot of popular support, and a lot of Afghans came back. That's when the Soviets invaded, many Afghans, of course, went into exile because of the brutality of the Russians. But on the other hand, the Russians had 10 years in this country, and they learned a lot, particularly like their special forces who got to be very good. And further, to the average Afghan, the U.S. and the Russians looked very similar. And in fact, you know, there were a lot of stories about U.S. forces going into the hinterland and the Afghans saying, oh, the Russians are here again. Because, you know, we're both foreigners. We speak a different language. We're infidels in a very religious society. And we're bringing an alien ideology to Afghanistan. And so to many Afghans, you know, we look a lot like the Soviets. And I think that missing that point was crucial. The other point that I make is that we also look a lot like the 19th century imperialists, and this, you know, makes Americans very nervous. But, you know, 19th century imperialists went to various corners of the globe, and they brought modernity, and they brought the rule of law and modern economics, and they brought Christianity, you know, a value system. Well, what do? You know, we bring the nation state, we bring globalization, and we bring 21st century human rights. You know, it looks, you know, if you are on the receiving end, this looks a lot like the 19th century imperialists, you know, bringing in alien concepts. Now, we believe that those are the right concepts, and I do believe them. You know, I'm not saying that they're wrong concepts, but if you're on the receiving end, you know, it's very disruptive.
And again, and one more thing. This has never occurred in the history of the planet, that which we're, you know, undertaking. You know, so when you look at Germany and Japan, you know, Korea, to a lesser extent than Germany and Japan, modern industrial nations, right, that we occupied and were there for decades and are still there in with military bases. But when you look at Afghanistan, they have existed as city states largely. And run by warlords. And so you look at that and you just, again, that's why that OP team, I get a splitting headache whenever I think about it. Like, who?
If I could have,
go ahead.
If I could have gone to that OPT, your hypothetical OPT, I would have said, okay, the example you should have in your head, the optimistic example, is South Korea. Because the United States occupies South Korea in 1945. When the Japanese leave, the United States occupies the South, of course. And then there's the Korean War in 1950-1953. And the United States kept whatever the number is, 20,000 troops there. I think there were more earlier on, and the number has come. And they're still there. And in 1945, South Korea was poor. It was rural. It had a weak state. It had a very Confucian, patriarchal culture. And, you know, in some ways, look a lot like Afghanistan. People forget that South Korea was the poor half of Korea. The rich half of Korea was the North, which had the industrialization. Okay, so 50 years later, it's now the mid-1990s, South Korea is now emerging as a modern state.
Right.
And it's in the 1990s that you have, and I think it's the early 1990s, you actually have a democratic election where power is shifted from, you know, the party that had been in power for many, many years to the opposition party. And since then, it's gone back and forth a couple of times. South Korea is now part of the G20, you know, one of the, you know, major economic countries in the world. And they also changed their constitution, I think, in the early 21st century to take out references to this Confucian patriarchal society and make it more egalitarian. So it takes, you know, 50, 60 years to get South Korea from where it was, which might even have been a little more developed than Afghanistan, but it was still very primitive, to a modern state. And over that time, we had had, you know, 40,000 down to 20,000 troops. So what I would say to this hypothetical OPT is, okay, if you want to accomplish these nation-building goals, that's what you should have in mind. We're going to have 40,000 troops there, you know, for 20 years, and then over the course of the next 30 years, we can ramp it down to maybe 20,000. So, you know, in the year 2050, we'll be down to 20,000 troops in Afghanistan. And by that time, you know, maybe you're now seeing Afghanistan emerge as, you know, a 21st century country. Now, are you willing to do that? And, of course, everyone would be screaming and running for the doors at that point.
Right. No, okay. No. God. No.
Right.
So I want you to relate this to something for me. Relate this to the argument about the War Powers Act and not declaring war, which means that successive presidents can grab the joystick and turn it left or right with and use it as a political issue to be elected or whatnot. Can you weave that into this and the way this happens? Because when you look at the argument you lay out, you know, and so should that be something that is told to the American people? And when we got to that crossroads, you know, was it teed up in that fashion? Were there hearings about it in front of or behind closed doors with the Senate and the House Armed Services Committee? You know, what this would mean? And again, while this is going on, Iraq is blowing up, right? So much of Afghanistan, when you go back in time, right, is occurring. We've already really solved Afghanistan. We haven't got Osama bin Laden yet, but we've kind of solved the Taliban issue, and then boom, Iraq blows up. And the focus of the nation, right, the video that's coming out, the, you know, 90% of it is Iraq. And Afghanistan's a B-team event. And I know guys don't like to hear that, but that's among combatants, I want to go to Iraq, man. It's on in Iraq. Now, it was on in areas of Afghanistan, but it didn't get covered so much. And so the backdrop of these discussions go on while Fallujah is ballooning up, while Ramadi's blowing up, while Baghdad's blowing up. So it kind of is, I don't want to say it happens on the down low, but it kind of does.
Yeah. It does. You know, it does. It happens. The shift in mission happens in 2002, 2004, which is right when the war in Iraq is you know, ramping up and then in its early stages. But the point you're sort of alluding to is it is important for the Congress to have some hearings on this. Now, Congress had no hearings on this shift in mission.
Wow.
It would be important to do that. One of the things I recommend in the report is that this discussion be tied to changes in the authorization for the use of military force called the AUMF,
right,
which functions as a declaration of war nowadays. You know, there are no, we don't do declarations of war anymore, but the AUMF spells out, passed by the Congress and spells out what we're going to use military force for. And that would be a good mechanism to have this discussion around.
Why? Because can you link it to again? I use the War Powers Act, but if there Congress provides the continuity, in my opinion, between somebody running a conflict starts anywhere, and if Congress is not involved in that declaration, then whoever runs in the next presidential race is going to run against the war because, I mean, who wants war? And they're going to run and all that without Congress there to say the nation's course is committed to this. And unless you can convince Congress to change that course, we are committed to this. Can you link those things?
Well, the value of an AUMF is that it is passed by the Congress. So, you know, that is there are a number of members that who have voted for this and therefore, you know, will, one presumes, defend it. The other thing is that, you know, AOMFs basically say the United States may use military force to accomplish this. And it's the this part that the report focuses on, because the argument that the report makes and that I've been making in this discussion is that the end state matters. You know, if you are only trying to eliminate Al-Qaeda, that's a very narrow goal.
Right.
If you're trying to transform Afghanistan, that is a broad goal. And you can bring that into the AUMF, or at least that would be the hope. It is, however, very hard to do. In other words, you see this with the Obama administration. When Obama gets up and describes his Afghan policy, he starts off by saying, we are focused on defeating Al-Qaeda. I think he uses the word defeat. Defeating Al-Qaeda. Great. Okay, narrow focus. He wants to get out of Afghanistan. That's great. And then he goes on to describe nation building. And while we're there, we're going to beat the Taliban, and we're going to establish schools, and we're going to strengthen the government, and we're going to bring human rights, and we're going to empower women and girls. And he goes on and on and on to describe nation building.
Right.
And the problem is, what he's showing is that he just can't give up on the nation building goals. It's just very hard for decision makers to get up there and say, you know, yeah, we don't really care so much about, you know, the rights of ethnic minorities or women and girls or democratic processes, or, you know, we are willing to give those up in order to focus just on the very narrow thing we care about and, you know, to keep our commitment to a...
But which sounds pretty callous until, you know, to me, if you paint with a little bit broader brush, our assessment is that in order to do that, we would be fighting for probably close to 30 years. We would spend another probably two generations, call it 60 years, occupying the nation. And I don't believe that the United States is interested in occupying Afghanistan for 100 years. And so to me, it sounds callous until you say that. But it doesn't sound like any of that debate even happened, and we embarked on this down this road to attempt to fashion something out of Afghanistan that was so far beyond our reach that it's in hindsight it's 2020. How and so you're a Harvard guy, so that means you're a smart guy. How could the Bush administration, right, screw it up so badly? I mean, and part of this is, I mean, their view of the world. How could they screw it up so badly in both places? I mean, they destabilized the entire Middle East, and that, which has bled up into Europe, and that is a Bush administration event. And we paid for it for the last 18 years. And similarly, the expansion of the ground war is a Bush administration event. How did Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, how did they screw it up so bad?
Well, focusing on Afghanistan again.
Okay.
You see remarkable continuity between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in terms of the goals. And so it's not just the Bush administration. Now, the Bush administration, of course, is very taken with the idea of the spread of democracy and that this is, you know, a natural element of the human, you know, motivation, and that, you know, people would rally to these concepts. And I think, you know, we now realize that that's much harder than we had thought. But, you know, you look at the Obama administration, as I noted, you know, they were just as wedded to these goals as the Bush people. So it goes much deeper into the American and Western psyche. It's not, in fact, our coalition partners, NATO partners, are probably even more committed to these goals. You know, their publics are very sensitive to human rights, and, you know, if there were a hint that we were stepping back from those in order to get an agreement, they would lose a lot of support. The difficulty, one way to get out of this difficulty sort of go back to your OPT, is to frame it in terms of if-then statements. One of the things the report says is that it's very difficult for senior military officers to get up in front of senior civilians who have very strong opinions, you know, read Rumsfeld or Obama, who has, you know, pledged to end the war, and tell them, you know, hey, this is, you know, your policy is going to take much longer. It is not possible, not feasible. If then statements sort of get around that and say, okay, Mr. President, President Obama, to accomplish the goals you laid out in your speech, it's going to take another 40 years in Afghanistan, and we're going to have to keep maybe 40,000 troops there initially. And, of course, the Obama administration started screaming at that point because their idea was they were going to get down to zero pretty quickly. But then if the administration said, that is not acceptable, then you say, okay, then let's talk about some other end states that we can't accomplish with fewer resources rather than accomplishing the original end state with fewer resources. And that's the problem that McChrystal got into. He accepted these very broad, this very broad mission, this very broad nation-building agenda, and then ended up arguing about how many resources, and of course the administration was constantly trying to squeeze him down. He was trying to get more when he should have brought the end state into play and argued that, you know, with fewer resources, he could accomplish fewer objectives.
At what point does a military leader, because I don't recall, maybe it happened and I don't know about it. I don't recall any leaders coming back. I remember General Shinseki testifying before, I'm not sure if it was the House or Senate Armed Service Committee, but testifying that you're going to need more than 200, and I think the number he used was 230,000 to garrison, if you will, Iraq after the fighting ensued, and Secretary Rumsfeld showed him the door. And I don't recall anybody else going down that road.
Newbold. General Newbold.
The only one, right, who resigned over it.
Yeah.
And General Zinni,
right.
General Zinni had already resigned. He was the most vocal critic of the entire strategy. But we've been escorted, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, by general officers who one would think, given their, you know, their education at places like the War College and things like that, in a variety of different places, right? And the pride that the Vietnam generation, probably officers older than you, right? And you were raised by them. They were so proud of the fact that we did not get involved in any other quote unquote Vietnams in post-Vietnam. Yet now the nation is now going to be encumbered. And nobody stands up and says, with all that education, with the lessons of Vietnam that they've learned from the time they've come in the Marine Corps. I mean, guys like Neller Neller's a little bit junior to you, right? And so you guys live with that stuff. Most of your careers, and yet nobody stands up and say, hey, I have to tell you. And we go to and so to me, the most troublesome part of this is the failure of general officers and flag officers in the American military to speak truth to power, no matter how much they say it. That the majority of those guys are conformists and want to be promoted, no matter what they say. All you have to do is look at the body of work. Is that a major issue in all this?
Yes, it is. And that's why I come back to this notion of if-then statements, because it is hard to go to a Rumsfeld and say, Mr. Secretary, you know, what you're proposing isn't going to work. Because, that's right, he'll throw you out. Shinseki and Newbold both had that experience. That's why I come back to this if-then approach. Mr. Secretary, we can do what you want if, but then we have to have this level of resources, but we can, you know, do something less with fewer resources. One of the problems I think, well, first of all, the problem you get into, the senior military leadership gets into, is when they accept these broad goals and then argue about resources is that they are constantly talking about all the progress that they've been making. You know, there's Duffel Blog, you know, one of the satirical websites, has an article, you know, current commander in Afghanistan cites great progress, just like the previous 17 commanders. And, you know, even though it's obviously a stalemate. The other problem is that they're constantly asking for more troops and more resources. So you get into this dynamic of, hey, things are going really great, we're making progress, we need more troops. And the way to get out of it is, my argument, is to start talking about end states. And part of the problem with military doctrine is it really doesn't talk about end states. When you go into 3-24 or JP 3-0 operations, operations talks about end states. It says, yeah, there is this thing, an end state. But it talks about the end state in a static way. That is, the civilians lay out an end state and then you build a plan to accomplish that end state. And it doesn't talk about the interaction between choices about end states and the effect on duration and intensity of military operations. So it doesn't give any sense that if your resources are limited, then you should limit your ambitions about the end state, and that the military ought to say that. This gets back up to a more fundamental discussion about civil-military relations. You know, there is what's called the normal view of civil-military relations, which is the civilians set the goals, the military then implement, and each one of them stays in their own spheres, so that the civilians stay out of the military sphere and the military stays out of the civilian sphere. And that all sounds great, except you get into this one problem about Vietnam, that is, you have expansive goals, not enough resources, same thing in Afghanistan. The second thing is, at the highest levels, you really can't make that distinction. You can't, you know, the goals, the political goals and the military effort become so intertwined that you really can't separate them. So you have to talk to them about them together. A fellow named Elliot Cohen, who is over at SAIS, where I teach, actually, and Elliot and I have known from each other for many years. He wrote a book called Supreme Command, and he makes this argument that at the top levels, you have to have a dialogue between military and civilian to thrash out questions about end state strategy forces so that you have a common understanding and agreement. And that's where the report comes out and, you know, urges senior military officers to have this discussion.
How, Mark, how do we need to be coaching them on that? That's what's, I guess, okay, so they have to be, and forgive me for dumbing this down, but they have to be led by the hand and be given this, a format. For does that help them develop the moral courage to look at a guy like Don Rumsfeld and say, hey, this is not going to, or this can work in 100 years? Are you going to say
right.
that? I mean, because to me, again, you're going to get to what at the root of this is, well, if this, then this, if this, then this, are you going to say this to him? And so I don't know. To me, at the center of all of this is the moral courage of a military leader to look at a civilian and say, we can't, that is beyond what we're capable of unless you say this.
Right.
And so...
Well, my notion about if-then is to try to make that a little easier on the military officer.
Right.
In other words, instead of standing up in front of Rumsfeld and saying, that won't work, say, if-then, or in the terms of Afghanistan, if you want to adopt those nation-building goals, then we're going to have to be there for 50 years. And so you're not saying it can't be done. The military is not saying no to the civilians, because that would be inappropriate. I mean, the civilians do get to decide. But the military is putting a marker down about what it's going to take. And getting to that point, of course, is challenging. One of the things that I think can help is, you know, changing the doctrine, for example, and the way we teach it so that there's more of a recognition about the interaction between end states and resources. duration and intensity of the conflict, and that end state is a variable. It's not fixed. And the other thing is, another recommendation in the report, is to continue to develop strategists, military strategists. But the important thing about military strategists is that they have to be credible as military officers. You can get a whole bunch of civilian strategists and very, very good, very, very smart people to advise you on strategy. The advantage of a military strategist is that he or she can be credible to a senior officer, because ultimately, as you've been saying, you've got to have that four-star willing to go into the Secretary of Defense and say, if you want to expand the goals, then it's going to take this amount of time and this amount of resources. And they'll only be willing to do that if they have confidence in their strategist. And not all, you know, senior officers have that confidence, and that's why it's important for them, for the military strategist to be credible in a military sense. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you a counterexample, which is Tommy Franks. Tommy Franks talked about the 50-pound brains, you know, the people in the strategic groups, you know, the 50-pound brains. That was not a compliment. You know, now some people might think, oh, that's a great compliment. You know, this, he's saying they're really smart. No, he's saying they are not war fighters like me. They are something different. They're academics. They're eggheads. They're not war fighters like me. And as a result, he's not willing to take their advice. So my argument is, no, the military strategists have to be credible as military officers as well as being strategists. And the caution then for the military is that very often there's a temptation to make the military strategists look more like civilian strategists rather than military officers. And what I'm saying is no, they have to be military officers, because you can hire a lot of civilian strategists. And I don't say that cynically. Many of the general officers in Iraq, and particularly in Afghanistan, you know, Petraeus, for example, you know, would have a cadre of civilian strategists to advise him. I think that's perfectly valid, and I think, and I know many of the people who went over, they're very smart people, they're very good people, but they're not military, and they don't have that kind of credibility.
If I write down and I start in Vietnam, and then I go to the Mayaguez incident, and then I go to Beirut, and then I go to Grenada, and then I go to Desert Storm, and then I go to Somalia, then I go to Iraq, then I go to Afghanistan, then I go back to Iraq, right? And then I go to Syria. I can make a pretty valid case that the thing that you're talking about, if this, then this, either didn't happen or the intellectual rigor devoted in most of those things that I mentioned, Desert Storm being an absolute anomaly, was absent, and that we have failed when we have attempted to apply, you know, military force in the vast majority of things that we have attempted. Yet I don't know that that's a horizontal line of learning in the American military. And what you're saying seems to be the Achilles heel of the American military, that either our generals in Vietnam, I mean, I don't know that, and give me your opinion on this, is there a more depressing book to read than H.R. McMaster's Dereliction of Duty?
No.
Oh, my God. If you want to spend a depressing week, grab that one, right, and have some Prozac standing by, because it's horrible. And yet, you know, Somalia, you talk about Somalia and mission creep.
Absolutely.
Right? And you look at Iraq, you know, completely misjudging what we're capable of, what the art of the possible was there, and doing the same thing, not initially in Afghanistan, but subsequently in Afghanistan, to the point where we've squandered, you know, close to 7,000 lives, right, and have not achieved anything close to what we sought to achieve in terms of end states that were articulated in either Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's why I think your work is so important, and it needs to be amplified from the highest mountains, because military leaders have to take a more forcible position to prevent these things from happening in the future. Or we're going to see, you know, again, I think one of the, you know, and I think about Vietnam veterans who look at 58,000 names on a wall and know that you know, that they left there and did not achieve, we as a nation did not achieve our national goals in Vietnam. Now people will say that, oh, 50 years later we did. Yeah, maybe. All right. But I don't know that makes Vietnam veterans feel any better. And now those veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are looking down the same, you know, historical viewpoint. Did what we do make a difference? And why do we keep failing when we attempt to apply military force? And you at least give, you know, a technique to people in positions of power that they can rightly, you know, apply, you know, something you've done, right? Quantitative analysis to a hypothetical course of action and give you some, you know, cost benefit analysis of what it will take to get there. But it just seems like this is such a problem for us, you know, in terms of grand strategy, as John Allen would call it.
Yeah. Well, and one of the recommendations of the report also is to take more seriously history and the experience of others. I come back to the Soviet experience that we should have studied that in tremendous detail to figure out what they did right and what they did wrong. You know, all of the problems we're having with the Afghan army, the Soviets already had. You know, we could have jumped forward 5 years if we had just studied their experience more closely. So, and that's part of, you know, being a superpower, this feeling that history does not constrain us, that we are beyond history. You know, we make history. The other thing is, this notion about end states, because you could also point to Korea, you know, where you see mission creep. You know, originally we were going to restore the border. We get to the border and we said, hey, you know, let's just conquer the whole country. And, of course, the Chinese didn't go along with that. So, that, you know, this question about focusing on end states, my hope is that people will start talking about that, that will get written into doctrine, so that military officers will be thinking about that when they have these discussions. And it's hard for a single military officer to get up there and say, you know, I think, you know, or if then, if this, then this, if not, if everyone else isn't supporting them. But if the Joint Chiefs have all been through the same experience, they've all looking at the same doctrine, and they all walk up there and say, yes, if you want to turn Afghanistan into a 21st century state, then we're going to have to be there for the next 50 years, you know, then maybe the civilians will listen.
Well, if they don't, then to me, that's where you get to the point where you have to resign. General Zinni was on, and he was talking about, you know, we talked about the whole issue of resigning, and which is not really in the blood of guys that have risen that high in the corporation. And so I asked him, I said, well, at what point, if you would have been CENTCOM, what point would you have resigned? He said when Rumsfeld sent his public affairs guys to do public affairs at CENTCOM, I would have, that would have been the final straw if I hadn't already resigned. He said essentially what he did was all the years, all the work that had gone into the war plan on Iraq, he ripped it up.
Right.
He ripped it up and he wrote his own war plan. He said, and the world, the region and the world is paying for that. And so to me, it's a pretty glaring example of how, and when you say, okay, we have to give your little, your TTP of if then, if that, this, we have to give that a name. The Kantian,
I like it.
Allegory or something like that.
Well, in fact, you know, I think we can go out to the radio audience and ask them. All right, you know, what's a good name for this dynamic, this if then, and we'll pick the most compelling idea.
Right. Let me finish my thought. If we use right the Kantian allegory or whatever we're going to call it, right, that plan gets 9 thumbs down out of 8. I mean, it just, so it befuddles me that everybody stood around, and again, I have H.R. McMaster's book in my head, like the Joint Chiefs did in Vietnam, knowing that it was, this can't succeed, but not saying anything for whatever reason, I'm not sure. And I just don't, maybe you can educate me about salute points and being that high in the government and saying, you know, my job is to make this work. I take, you know, but if you don't think that it's taking the nation to the right place, don't you have a moral obligation to resign or not?
I think so, because one of the things you said that I'm going to push back on is that the military should prevent these wars from happening. That's not the military's role. I mean, the civilians get to decide. What the military can do is get up and say, okay, 50 years, you know, 40,000 troops for 50 years. And, you know, and if the civilians say, no, we want nation building, but we're going to give you 10,000 troops, that's when, you know, the senior military officers have to have the willingness to resign or to do something collectively. My hope is that,
right,
you know, if you change the doctrine and you change the training to so that people are aware of this, then when you get up to the Joint Chiefs, you can get 6 signatures on a letter that says, if you want to do that, Mr. President, it's going to take 50 years. And you don't have to have an individual making this terrible decision about, you know, do you resign or not? Because, you know, the other thing I'm sensitive to is the uncertainty that these senior leaders are operating under. It's very easy for us to look back on 18 years and say, you know, in 2004, you made this terrible mistake. And much harder when you are in that time, you know, looking forward to an uncertain future to see clearly what it is you should do.
But it's no more difficult than a fire team leader that doesn't have ISR overhead, that's walking down the street in Ramadi or in Marja, that says, all right, boys, not really sure what's going to go down today, but that's where we're headed. I mean, I agree with you, and I remember, is it General Johnson, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in
Chief of Staff of the Army,
that said he had to go to his grave. Do you remember the quote I'm talking about?
Yep. He was going to the White House. He was going to resign over Vietnam, feeling that the resources were not adequate, and he decided not to do it, that he could be more effective by staying in uniform, and he said, and he would take that mistake to his grave,
right,
which he did.
Right. And so that decision is no harder than the decisions that we ask Marines to make in combat every day on the lives of those they lead. But here's what I see, and this is my criticism of general officers. They shrink from it. We have been escorted to every one of these disasters by the general officers of the United States military. And I think that has to stop. And if it's a tool like yours, that's called the up or down test, the Kantian up or down test. I like its simplicity. But again, if it's down, then you have a moral decision to make. And you would hope that, right, you as a group of 6 go to the Senate Armed Service Committee and the House Armed Service Committee in closed session and say, we have to brief you about this, because this is how strongly we feel about this.
Although being a denizen of Washington, what I would say is, no, what you do is you have your staff talk to the congressional staffers and you say, we'd really like the chairman to ask the general this question. So when you're in either closed session or even open session, you know, then the chairman says, now, general, what do you think it would take to transform Afghanistan along the lines of nation building we've described? And that's when he's like, I'm glad you asked me that question, Senator. It's going to take 50 years. Many of these questions get actually planted by the Pentagon.
Talk to me at the end of the day, when you looked at this issue, and again, my guest today is retired Marine Colonel Mark Kansian, and working at CSIS, and his work is entitled, you can see a very interesting video that he's in about this, as well as read about it in both executive summary format and the long format. But it's called Tell Me How This Ends, Military Advice, Strategic Goals, and the Forever War in Afghanistan. And that's what we've been talking about. And we haven't been talking about just Afghanistan, but we kind of had a liberal arts discussion here in the last hour. For people that are troubled by this, as I am, give us something that offers us hope for the future, as we now have a new tool to use in these huge, huge decisions about the commitment of American resources, both in combat, and then most importantly, winning in phase four and leaving something better, which would be the whole goal of what we do. Give us some reason to hope that we can stop screwing this up as a nation.
Well, one thing I hope that we keep talking about this issue and thinking about how is it that 18 years later we're still there with at best a stalemate. My fear is that the U.S. military will do what it did after Vietnam, which is we're never going to do that again, so we're going to even stop thinking about it. We're going to go back to wars that make us comfortable, that is, big wars against nation states. We have to keep thinking about these stability operations and, as I argue, end states and military effort. But I'd also argue that thinking about end states is just as relevant when you're talking about conflicts with great powers as they are when you're talking about conflicts in places like Afghanistan. If there were, God forbid, a conflict with China, thinking about what it is you wanted to accomplish would be critical on the front end, because there's a big difference between hemming the Chinese in, you know, the seven-dash line there, right, the first island chain, and trying to overthrow the Chinese government or striking their homeland, or, you know, trying to attack their economy. And thinking,
well, can you show me how you would do this relative to Iran?
Absolutely. I hope that in the Situation Room they are having this discussion. In other words, if there is a military action in Iran, what is it we want to accomplish? John Bolton is going to get up there and say, regime change. And I'm hoping that the Joint Chiefs are saying, okay, we can do regime change. It's going to take 400,000 troops, 500 aircraft, and half the U.S. Navy to do it, because you're going to have to really apply a great deal of military pressure, given that the strength of this regime. But if what you want to do is to whack Iran so they stop bothering their neighbors, they stop mining tankers, they stop shooting down aircraft, we can do that with some punitive strikes at different levels. I'm certainly hoping they're having that discussion.
So that's the if that, then this, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
If you want the regime change, then it's going to take 400,000 troops. I mean, I'm making that number up, but it's going to take a huge military effort. You know, if you want to scale back Iranian aggression in the region, then you can do it with much less.
Now, does that need to be done in public as well? I can't even remember the last title I used for your tool. The Kansian algorithm,
upper down
tool. If it falls in the forest, does it make a sound? If it falls behind closed doors, is this something that needs to be done in front of the American people too? Leaked?
Well, no. I think if the military and the civilians are going to have a candid conversation about this, and it's going to be it has to be a candid, and it's going to be a very difficult conversation. They need to have some confidence that they can have that discussion candidly, you know, that they can put their opinions out there and not be worried it's going to be in the Washington Post the next day by someone who's, you know, sort of maneuvering on the other side. So that part of the discussion has to be done very quietly. Now, having said that, I mean, there's a role for the Congress and a public discussion. I mean, the Congress can hold hearings. The Congress can ask questions to have a more public discussion about this. But in the administration, it really needs to be tightly held. Otherwise, you get into this dynamic that you saw in the Obama administration, where the White House thought that the military was undermining them, and therefore they stopped or they reduced their engagement with the military, and then you get into all the pathologies we talked about.
All right. That's interesting because to me, so that it goes public when I resign as the chairman or the commandant of the Marine Corps or a member of the Joint Chief. So I resign, and then I sit down and have my press conference and say, this is why I resigned today.
If it comes to that.
All right. One
hopes that at the end of this, the president will come out and announce a policy that conforms to the kind of dynamic we've been talking about. In other words, if it's very expansive, he says, we're going to go for regime change and I'm sending 400,000 troops to the Middle East, military can do that. Or he says, we're going to have a series of punitive strikes and our goal is to reduce Iranian aggression in the region. We can live with that too. And the civilians get to make that decision. The thing about the military is they just want to make sure that the ends and the ways and the means are all tied together.
Talk to me about the Colin Powell pottery barn rule. Now, Powell says he did not say this, that Tom Friedman wrote it, but so they can argue about that. But it's essentially you break it, you bought it. Although Powell says he said that, he never used the words the pottery barn, but that's one of the places where you see that. Talk to us about that American notion. And for instance, I would offer you something General Cindy said. We could have gone into Afghanistan. We should have gone in there much harder. We should have jumped the 82nd Airborne and the 102nd Airborne up into Tora Bora, accepted those casualties, and been done with it in short order, looked at the Afghans and said, do not allow any of this again, or we will come swinging a chain again. But if you've read 12 minutes of Afghan history, you know you don't want to own this son of a bitch, and left.
Yeah.
Contrast the pottery barn rule and the American notion of the Marshall Plan and pottery barn with reality.
Yeah, I think we, at least I hope, we have all soured on the pottery barn rule because we don't want to own these countries. We don't want to own Afghanistan. We don't want to own Iraq. We don't want to own Somalia. So we are not obligated to fix them. And the dynamic you outlined, I think, is perfectly viable. Now, you're saying we're not going to transform Afghanistan or one of these countries into a 21st century state. We're going to let them do whatever it is they're going to do. But if they get outside the parameters that we can accept, like they start hosting Al-Qaeda again and Al-Qaeda starts plotting against the United States, then we're going to come back. And I think a good model for this is the 1972 Easter Offensive in Vietnam. By 1972, the United States had almost all of its ground forces out of Vietnam. The North Vietnamese invaded. They made a very conventional attack across the DMZ. The United States supported the South Vietnamese with immense firepower and naval power. And also, we also had some advice on the ground to help out there. That turned out to be very effective. The North Vietnamese, made some progress, but they were stopped. They were ground down by the air power, and then the South Vietnamese were able to push them back across the border. And we could do the same thing in Afghanistan. We could say exactly what you did, which is, hey, if you ever let Al-Qaeda back in, you know, we'll be back. And then if they do, then all of a sudden the B-52s are flying overhead dropping JDAMs, and, you know, that's the end of Al-Qaeda. And then we go back, and then if they try it again, you know, we send the B-52s over again without having to you know, have a large ground presence, and certainly without having to own the country.
Right. So the Pottery Barn. All right, Mark, I've taken up a bunch of your time. First of all, where can people find find your study?
It's online. If you go to CSIS.org, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, it's on their website. If you have any trouble, you can go to Experts, Mark Cancian, and then it's listed under my publications. And I think if you just Googled Mark Cancian, CSIS Afghanistan, it would pop up. And there are two products. I mean, the one is the report itself, and the other one is the video of the panel discussion we had where we rolled out the report, and then I had some other experts and scholars talk about the general issues that the report raises, not the report itself.
Got it. And those links will be are included in this post if you haven't seen them. What, this is the general question, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you in the last 90 minutes as we've talked about? Because I think that what you're writing about is question one when the nation gets pointed towards war. So when I shouldn't even say that. When a nation gets pointed towards conflict, this is question one. All right? If this, then what? At what cost? At how many years? At how many lives? And hard, diverse intellectual work in that area is the moral obligation for the people that lead the nation. And you've got to be prepared to resign, I think, should this thing not go, should this thing go outside the parameters that a leader at that level sees. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about all of this that you want people to know?
I think we've been over this pretty thoroughly. The only things I would emphasize is this notion about end states really matters, you know, what it is you're trying to accomplish, and that making 21st century societies and polities is very difficult. And the second thing is that we can't avoid this question. We can't just say we're never doing that again and then stop thinking about it, because we always do it again, and it's relevant for all conflicts, not just stability operations.
Not just the big ones. Not just big ones. No. All right, give me a...
No, because
people want to apply this, right, to the big questions, right? But I would say, you know, to emphasize your point, this technique... Right. This is valid in when you talk about any conflict, no matter the scale that you would talk about, because the end state is really, really important, and that the end state has to be congruent with American, you know, foreign policy interests, American national interest, and it all should sing the same tune, and that's why I think it's so important. That's why it's so gut-wrenching to look at Afghanistan and the way that happened and where we are today with it. Mark, give me a good book to read that you've read here recently, or give me a good, something good to read.
Along this line, actually, Jonathan Schroden, S-E-H-R-O-D-E-N, who's over at CNA and was on my panel, has written a couple of pieces in War on the Rocks, which is a, you know, online military publication about Afghanistan, and he talks a lot about these issues. The other one is Dan Bolger, who's a retired Army 3-star, who wrote about Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, basically how we lost those wars. And I, both of them, I relied on quite heavily in putting, you know, this report together. So I would recommend both of them.
And what's the title of Bolger's book? Put you on the.
But it's something along the line of like of you know how we lost the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Why we lost the general's inside account of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars by Daniel P. Bolger.
There you go. And I interviewed Bolger for this work, and you know, I'd say he's very insightful and very, very candid. The book is quite refreshing in its candor about what people did well and what people didn't do well.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, Mark, if you can't tell, I really enjoy these kind of liberal arts discussions over things that have affected so many lives in our country, the things that have affected so many civilian lives, people who will never see the United States, and have affected them so tremendously. And I think I love these conversations. I don't know that we do it enough. And I'm a huge fan of articulate discourse, and it's been wonderful having you on the program today. Thank you very much for doing this, and I hope you don't mind in the future if I give you a call and we do this again over some different topic.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Smart guy stuff for the last almost 2 hours. Yeah, how about that for a dose of it? Now, I have this to say about that. I mean, and this would be my quarrel with Mark. So you give them another tool. Does that fortify their spine enough to stand up and do what so many seem to not be able to do? And so he lays it all out. But I mean, come on, my own opinion is that they know they're supposed to do that. They just don't do it. Which is frustrating. So, I don't rightly know what to say about that. I think his tool is absolutely valid, but if you don't have the moral courage to do what you're supposed to do in those positions, and that's what I see as the problem. The moral courage. So, again, but, you know, you can tell I'm struggling. I love that, you know, we're having the conversation, obviously. I mean, I like the clarity provided. The clarity and the tool and all that. I think they know that. And that's why I think in the structure, you have to have a guy whose job it is, right, to get admonished to shut up. Yeah, well, you know, that's, you know, General, you know, Lynch or Kenny. He never shuts up. And he gets promoted on that. He's our designated public shit disturber. And he makes the rest of us answer this. And again, I mean, and let me tell you how reluctant they are. And this, in my opinion, is a problem. Dave Furness came out and said something that everybody knew was true. And you had Dale Alford, as far as I know, is the only general that came out in public and said anything in support of General Furness. Everybody else stuck their hands in their pockets and said, "Yeah, I ain't going there, man. Look, I just saw the firestorm he lit off. You know, that ain't for me." So, I don't... Those are our general officers. So, anyway, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. We're going to talk about American politics a little bit. I'll give you a little opinion. And then we'll check the news headlines. My opinion is, you know, given the fact that Donald Trump got served that whole dossier, and that then it got investigated for the first 2 years of his presidency, in his mind, right, attempting to destroy that which he legitimately won, do you think he's not going to miss a chance to tattoo it to the Democratic Party? Right? And these four Congress members, no matter what their color, are served to him, right? Sticking their necks out, saying things that are lies sometimes, that are, you know, for instance, you know, what is her name? Ilhan Omar. She says, well, somebody did something, right, on September 11th. Like, are you fucking kidding me? So anyway, Donald Trump is not going to pass up, if the Democratic Party wants to go that far to the left, embrace that and not slap that stuff down. You know, all he's doing is giving them more face time. And what he's doing is he's coloring the perception of the middle third of the voters that he needs to get reelected, that the Democratic Party is the party of this. Right? And can you blame him? No. In fact, you'd probably hold him stupid if he didn't do it. But the pathetic landscape, right, that is the American political landscape accommodates them, and it accommodates him. And we all know we wish it was something different, but it ain't. Right? It's victory at any cost. And I'll tell you that. I'll tell you this. If he didn't learn that in the election, he certainly learned it subsequent to the election, when they have absolutely laid the wood to him. And so, anyway, have a great day. All Marine Radio on a Tuesday. Headed for MCRD. Out.